Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, we hear part of a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. We close the show, as always, with an American story. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
A United States federal grand jury has charged 13 Russian nationals and three Russian companies with plotting to interfere in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The indictment, announced by the Justice Department, came from the Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller. The indictment says the defendants used fake social media accounts and stolen identities to influence political opinion. The Russians' goal was to create conflict, the indictment says. It says the defendants' efforts were meant to help the campaign of Republican Party candidate Donald Trump and hurt that of Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party nominee. The charges also say the defendants communicated with unwitting individuals linked to the Trump campaign and activists to organize political activities. President Trump himself has rejected any Russian interference in the campaign. On Friday, the president wrote on Twitter, "Russia started their anti-U.S. campaign in 2014, long before I announced that I would run for president. The results of the election were not impacted. The Trump campaign did nothing wrong. No collusion." The Justice Department named Mueller special counsel in May. The office is under orders to investigate any links and/or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald Trump. Last October, the grand jury also indicted Paul Manafort, who served as Trump's campaign chairman, and Rick Gates, another top campaign official. They were charged in connection with their work for the government of Ukraine, two Ukrainian political parties, and former President Viktor Yanukovych. George Papadopoulos, another advisor for the Trump campaign, admitted he had lied to federal investigators about meetings with a Russian agent in connection with the campaign. In December, a former national security advisor for Trump, Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty in an investigation led by Mueller's office. Flynn admitted to lying about his contacts with the Russian ambassador to the United States, Sergei Kislyak, before Trump's inauguration. Court papers also say that Flynn knows the identities of members of Trump's transition team that had detailed knowledge of his outreach to Russia. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
High up a long, winding road in the Appalachian Mountains, a small village is hidden among the hills and forest. Red Swiss flags hang from the tops of Swiss-style buildings. Above some of the doors are signs with German messages. "Folgen sein Seligkeit" reads one, meaning "follow his bliss." Among the businesses is a large Swiss restaurant. Visitors could, for a moment, think they were in Europe. But no, this is Helvetia, West Virginia, in the United States. A group of settlers from Switzerland settled Helvetia in 1869. West Virginia had only been a state for 6 years. Anna Chandler works for the Helvetian Archives, which records the history of the town through photos and documents. She says West Virginia's government was seeking to increase the state's population in its early years. So, she said, state employees traveled to the city of Bern in German-speaking Switzerland. There, they found people willing to travel to West Virginia and build a community. Helvetia has remained small to this day, and it also stayed true to its cultural roots. Or, as Clara Lehman, a member of the Helvetian Restoration and Development Association, explains, Helvetia is like a beautiful mixture of Swiss and Appalachian. Because of Helvetia's remoteness, traveling to or leaving the town was difficult, says Chandler. This has helped the town keep its strong Swiss identity.
Just that isolation makes it very difficult sometimes to bring new things in. So part of the fact that a lot of those traditions are still here is just because there was not a way for them to leave.
As of the most recent official count, 59 people live in Helvetia. Many are direct descendants from the original Swiss settlers. Lehman's great-grandfather, for example, was among the first Swiss settlers of Helvetia. She says that everyone on her mother's side of the family grew up in Helvetia. Lehman herself left Helvetia for a few years for school and work. However, she says she always felt a pull to return, and in time, she surrendered to it.
Part of those traditions means the town celebrates several Swiss holidays every year. The largest and most festive is called Fastnacht. It has Catholic roots, as Clara Lehman explains.
Fastnacht is a Swiss tradition. The root of the word is fasting night. It's a tradition that you practice before Lent. You're essentially gorging yourself and having excess right before you're going to be very austere, just like Mardi Gras and Carnival.
Helvetia's Fastnacht is observed on the Saturday before the start of the Christian period of Lent. Lent always begins in February or March. This year, Fastnacht took place on February 10th. In the town's early history, Lehman said, Fastnacht was only celebrated privately, at home, or with friends. However, in 1968, Lehman's grandmother, Eleanor Mayhew, and friends decided to make the festival a larger event for the town. As word of the event spread through West Virginia, Fastnacht grew in popularity. Now, hundreds of visitors come from surrounding communities to join the locals at the yearly party. The celebration begins in the afternoon when local musicians gather at Starband Hall to play music. Crowds come to eat, drink, and enjoy the sounds of live, old-time, folk, and country music. Later in the evening, people move outside and put on many different homemade masks. Similar to Mardi Gras, the Fastnacht masks represent escape from one's identity. This permits more freedom in behavior. We prepare masks in secret in our homes, Lehman said. Then, she said, mask wearers parade through town to the community hall, holding candle lampions. Inside the community hall, a model of Old Man Winter hangs. The masked marchers walk around it, trying to frighten winter away so that spring will come. At that point, the masks come off, the local Red Star band plays, and the dancing begins. Helvetia is known for dancing, and during Fasnacht, they demonstrate both their Appalachian and Swiss culture through square dances, waltzes, and Swiss polka dancing. Everyone is expected to dance. In Clara Lehmann's words, if you don't know how to dance, it doesn't matter because somebody's going to teach you. At midnight, the music stops. Partiers cut down Old Man Winter, carry it outside, and throw it on a big fire.
That is supposed to say, welcome spring, get out of here, winter.
Food is also important for Fasnacht. During the day, the town's only restaurant, the Hütte, prepares Swiss-German food. This includes Sauerbraten, Bratwurst, and Swiss cheese. Locals also prepare rosettes, a traditional Swiss pastry made with fried dough, which they serve during the dance. Tradition is important to the people of Helvetia, who have always valued community, says Anna Chandler.
This event that both Helvetia and some of the other communities around do through the year lets folks come home and celebrate the way they knew as a kid or as they remember their grandparents talking about.
Continuing those traditions in Helvetia does have its difficulties. Economic problems in West Virginia have made it difficult for Helvetians to find jobs. The population has decreased over the years. But those still living in Helvetia refuse to let their culture disappear.
You have to really fight to maintain a tradition. But I think that what's really cool about Helvetia is we're super stubborn and we want to hold on to this Swiss identity. We see the value of holding on to some of these traditions that speak to your soul and that elevate your experience of life. So I think that's why we continue to do it.
I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Katie Weaver. Next up is Alice Winkler with part of another What It Takes podcast.
There were very few Nazi concentration camp survivors who were willing to tell their stories after World War II ended. A decade passed, and then some. They had lived through something that was beyond words. But Elie Wiesel, who had survived Auschwitz and Buchenwald, knew the stakes were too high for silence. His parents and younger sister had been killed. 6 million of his fellow Jews had been killed. He shattered the silence with a slim volume called Simply Night.
I pinched myself. Was I still alive? Was I awake? How was it possible that men, women, and children were being burned, and that the world kept silent? No. All this could not be real. A nightmare, perhaps. Soon I would wake up with a start, my heart pounding, and find that I was back in the room of my childhood with my books. My father's voice tore me from my daydreams. What a shame. A shame that you did not go with your mother. I saw many children your age go with their mothers. His voice was terribly sad. I understood that he did not wish to see what they would do to me. He did not wish to see his only son go up in flames. My forehead was covered with cold sweat. Still, I told him that I could not believe that human beings were being burned in our times. The world would never tolerate such crimes. The world is not interested in us. Today, everything is possible. Even the crematoria.
That excerpt was from the audiobook version of Night, read by actor George Guidall. Here is Elie Wiesel.
I wrote it not for myself, really. I wrote it for the other survivors who found it difficult to speak. And I wanted really to tell them, look, you must speak. As poorly as we can express our feelings, our memories, but we must try. I wrote it for them, because the survivors are the kind of most endangered species. Every day there are funerals. And I felt they were, for a while, they were so neglected, so abandoned, almost humiliated by society after the war.
Elie Wiesel's own funeral was just 2 weeks ago as I'm recording this podcast. The most outspoken witness of the Holocaust is gone. So we knew it was time to take his interview and his speeches out of the Academy of Achievements archive to share them with you.
To hear the whole podcast, go to the What It Takes section on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. Today, we hear The Lady or the Tiger by Frank Stockton. Here is Barbara Klein.
Long ago, in a very olden time, there lived a powerful king. Some of his ideas were progressive, but others caused people to suffer. One of the king's ideas was a public arena as an agent of poetic justice. Crime was punished, or innocence was decided, by the result of chance. When a person was accused of a crime, his future would be judged in the public arena. All the people would gather in this building. The king sat high up on his ceremonial chair. He gave a sign. A door under him opened. The accused person stepped out into the arena. Directly opposite the king were two doors. They were side by side, exactly alike. The person on trial had to walk directly to these doors and open one of them. He could open whichever door he pleased. If the accused man opened one door, out came a hungry tiger, the fiercest in the land. The tiger immediately jumped on him and tore him to pieces as punishment for his guilt. The case of the suspect was thus decided. Iron bells rang sadly. Great cries went up from the paid mourners. And the people, with heads hanging low and sad hearts, slowly made their way home. They mourned greatly that one so young and fair, or so old and respected, should have died this way. But if the accused opened the other door, there came forth from it a woman, chosen especially for the person. To this lady he was immediately married in honor of his innocence. It was not a problem that he might already have a wife and family, or that he might have chosen to marry another woman. The king permitted nothing to interfere with his great method of punishment and reward. Another door opened under the king, and a clergyman, singers, dancers, and musicians joined the man and the lady. The marriage ceremony was quickly completed. Then the bells made cheerful noises. The people shouted happily, and the innocent man led the new wife to his home, following children who threw flowers on their path. This was the king's method of carrying out justice. Its fairness appeared perfect. The accused person could not know which door was hiding the lady. He opened either as he pleased, without knowing whether, in the next minute, he was to be killed or married. Sometimes the fierce animal came out of one door. Sometimes it came out of the other. This method was a popular one. When the people gathered together on one of the great trial days, they never knew whether they would see a bloody killing or a happy ending. So everyone was always interested. And the thinking part of the community would bring no charge of unfairness against this plan. Did not the accused person have the whole matter in his own hands? The king had a beautiful daughter who was like him in many ways. He loved her above all humanity. The princess secretly loved a young man who was the best-looking and bravest in the land. But he was a commoner, not part of an important family. One day, the king discovered the relationship between his daughter and the young man. The man was immediately put in prison. A day was set for his trial in the king's public arena. This, of course, was an especially important event. Never before had a common subject been brave enough to love the daughter of the king. The king knew that the young man would be punished, even if he opened the right door. And the king would take pleasure in watching the series of events, which would judge whether or not the man had done wrong in loving the princess. The day of the trial arrived. From far and near, the people gathered in the arena and outside its walls. The king and his advisors were in their places opposite the two doors. All was ready. The sign was given. The door under the king opened, and the lover of the princess entered the arena. Tall, beautiful, and fair, his appearance was met with a sound of approval and tension. Half the people had not known so perfect a young man lived among them. No wonder the princess loved him. What a terrible thing for him to be there. As the young man entered the public arena, he turned to bend to the king. But he did not at all think of the great ruler. The young man's eyes instead were fixed on the princess, who sat to the right of her father. From the day it was decided that the sentence of her lover should be decided in the arena, she had thought of nothing but this event. The princess had more power, influence, and force of character than anyone who had ever before been interested in such a case. She had done what no other person had done. She had possessed herself of the secret of the doors. She knew behind which door stood the tiger and behind which waited the lady. Gold and the power of a woman's will had brought the secret to the princess. She also knew who the lady was. The lady was one of the loveliest in the kingdom. Now and then, the princess had seen her looking at and talking to the young man. The princess hated the woman behind that silent door. She hated her with all the intensity of the blood passed to her through long lines of cruel ancestors. Her lover turned to look at the princess. His eye met hers as she sat there, paler and whiter than anyone in the large ocean of tense faces around her. He saw that she knew behind which door waited the tiger and behind which stood the lady. He had expected her to know it. The only hope for the young man was based on the success of the princess in discovering this mystery. When he looked at her, he saw that she had been successful, as he knew she would succeed. Then his quick and tense look asked the question, "Which?" It was as clear to her as if he shouted it from where he stood. There was not time to be lost. The princess raised her hand and made a short, quick movement toward the right. No one but her lover saw it. Every eye but his was fixed on the man in the arena. He turned, and with a firm and quick step, he walked across the empty space. Every heart stopped beating. Every breath was held. Every eye was fixed upon that man. He went to the door on the right and opened it. Now, the point of the story is this. Did the tiger come out of that door, or did the lady? The more we think about this question, the harder it is to answer. It involves a study of the human heart. Think of it not as if the decision of the question depended upon yourself, but as if it depended upon that hot-blooded princess, her soul at a white heat under the fires of sadness and jealousy. She had lost him, but who should have him? How often in her waking hours and in her dreams had she started in wild terror and covered her face with her hands? She thought of her lover opening the door on the other side of which waited the sharp teeth of the tiger. But how much oftener had she seen him open the other door? How she had ground her teeth and torn her hair when she had seen his happy face as he opened the door of the lady. How her soul had burned in pain when she had seen him run to meet that woman with her look of victory. When she had seen the two of them get married, and when she had seen them walk away together upon their path of flowers, followed by the happy shouts of the crowd, in which her one sad cry was lost. Would it not be better for him to die quickly and go to wait for her in that blessed place of the future? And yet, that tiger, those cries, that blood. Her decision had been shown quickly, but it had been made after days and nights of thought. She had known she would be asked, and she had decided what she would answer, and she had moved her hand to the right. The question of her decision is one not to be lightly considered, and it is not for me to set myself up as the one person able to answer it. And so I leave it with all of you. Which came out of the open door? The lady or the tiger?
We have come to the end of today's show. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.